Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, we are continuing now with the discussion of the Chula Asapura Sutta. This is the shorter discourse at Asapura, Sutta number 40 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And it was actually 3 weeks ago that I last discussed the sutta, since in the intervening 2 weeks we had talks from Venerable Dhammadipa and Bhikkhuni Kusuma. So I just give a little review. Okay, the theme of this sutta is indicated in paragraph 2. The topic is how the Buddha is addressing the monks. He says that they are known as samanas, here translated recluses, but now I prefer ascetics. So he's asking them how they can merit or deserve the designation of ascetics. And he says that to do so, you should train according to the principle that we will practice the way proper to a samana, to a true ascetic. And in this way, the designation of ascetic will be genuine, and you will also be deserving of the requisites that people offer to you, and those requisites that people give you will be very fruitful for them. And then to highlight the idea of how one practices the way proper to the ascetic, the Buddha takes the negative case of how one is not practicing the proper way, and he enumerates a number of states which are called, elsewhere they're called, defilements of the mind, cittassa upakilesa. These are sort of secondary defilements, states which in some respect are synonymous with greed and aversion, greed and hatred. In other senses, other of these states are offshoots or branches or derivatives of greed and aversion. And of course, they're all rooted in ignorance or delusion. Covetousness, ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, fraud, deceit, evil wishes, and wrong view. And so one who is not abandoning these and not making any effort to abandon them is not practicing the way proper to an ascetic. And the Buddha says that this person is similar to, there's a weapon called the mattaja. Apparently it's a kind of knife or sword which is very sharp on both edges. And if such a sword were enclosed, or knife was enclosed in a patchwork sheath, that would be similar to a person like this. Then the Buddha says that the status of an ascetic, a true ascetic, doesn't come about, and he enumerates a variety of the extreme ascetic practices that were undertaken by his contemporaries in India at this time. There were these many practices that the renunciants would undertake with the belief that by subjecting themselves to these extreme austerities, they could attain purification. He mentions the first one is the wearing of the patchwork cloak. In some respects, this is Sangati is the name for one of the robes of a Buddhist monk. But I think what's referred to here would be not the Buddhist monk's robe, but those who just collect pieces of cloth, stitch them together, and wear them. Then there comes going about naked, dwelling in the dust and dirt, and various other ascetic practices. And the Buddha says if these practices led to the overcoming of the defilements, then people could take a newborn baby and just wrap the baby up in a patchwork cloak and say, come dear, just you go about wearing patchwork cloak, you go about naked, you go about dwelling in dust and dirt, and you'll be purified of your defilements. But it's not in this way that one abandons the defilements. And so the Buddha says that, now I'm at the bottom of page 373, after he mentions the last ascetic practice, wearing matted locks, having the, maybe you've seen pictures of the Shaivite ascetics. They have the very long hair and they weave the hair together, wind it together into these locks. So they look very frightful. Sometimes they have painted faces, very fierce expressions on their face. So he says, I do not say that the ascetic status comes about in a matted hair ascetic through the mere wearing of the matted hair. Okay, that's as far as we got last time. So now the Buddha is going to show, we're on the top of page 374. Now the Buddha raises the question, how a monk practices the way proper to the true ascetic. Okay, and he says, when any monk who is covetous has abandoned covetousness, when one who had a mind of ill will has abandoned ill will, when one who is angry has abandoned anger, who is resentful has abandoned resentment, who is contemptuous has abandoned contempt, who is insolent has abandoned insolence, who is envious has abandoned envy, who is avaricious has abandoned avarice, who is fraudulent has abandoned fraud, who is deceitful has abandoned deceit, who had evil wishes has abandoned evil wishes, who had wrong view has abandoned wrong view, then he practices the way proper to the recluse or ascetic, I say, because of his abandoning these stains for the recluse, these faults for the recluse, these dregs for the recluse, which are grounds for rebirth in a state of deprivation and whose results are to be experienced in an unhappy destination. Here the Buddha gives kind of very severe warning about the results of these unwholesome states. These last few lines, that they are grounds for rebirth. Here the phrase state of deprivation, I think the meaning is a little obscure, but in Pali the meaning would be very clear to somebody who knows the context. It's apaya. The apaya is a technical term for the three lower realms of rebirth. That is the hell realms, the animal realm, and the sphere of the petas, or tormented spirits. And also the expression unhappy destination, or dukkati, bad destinations, has the same the same meaning. And now this passage, I have to say, it seems, on the surface, it seems quite evident, the meaning. And then you take the next couple of lines, also it seems to confirm what appears to be the surface meaning. First sentence of paragraph 8, he sees himself purified of all these evil, unwholesome states. He sees himself liberated from them. So if you just take the what seems to be the manifest meaning of these lines, it appears that here the monk has achieved full liberation or full purification. But this doesn't seem possible because of what comes next. What comes next is a sequence that culminates in concentration, samadhi. And then as you read on, you see that the monk develops certain other qualities, and eventually the sutta will culminate in the destruction of the asavas, or taints. So this is the way I would understand this passage. And I refer to a table that I had made up earlier, if you remember, perhaps you have it with you, the table on defilements, antidotes, and types of abandonment. That I would understand the abandoning of these defilements spoken of in paragraph 7 and at the beginning of paragraph 8 to be what I call, using the commentarial term, specific factor abandonment, or in Pali it's tadanga bahana. That is, I would understand that here the monk is undertaking the preliminary stages of practice. He's observing the precepts as the basis of the path. So he's purifying, he's already purified his moral discipline or virtue, moral virtue. And I would understand him to be engaged in the preliminary stages of meditative development and reaching some level of success, maybe, in clearing the mind of the grosser defilements through the application of specific antidotes to these defilements. Because if he had really achieved complete liberation from the defilements, if he had uprooted the defilements, then the sutta would end here, wouldn't it? That would be like usually when the Buddha delivers a discourse, he builds it up to the climax, and the climax is the achievement of complete liberation. And then there's nothing to add after that. But now the Buddha brings in other sections on further stages of practice for this monk. So even though the Buddha, the Pali uses very strong words, visuddhaṃ atthānaṃ samanuppassati, vimuttaṃ atthānaṃ samanuppassati. Those are based on the noun visuddhi, which means purification, and vimutti, liberation. But if we see this as real, complete purification, complete liberation, then why bring in the sequence building up to samadhi? Why bring in the four sublime states? Then why bring in, at the end of the discourse, the destruction of the asavas, of the defilements? What do you think, Venerable Analia? Okay, so I would say that this temporary purification, temporary liberation, is what gives some sense of deepened confidence in the teaching. So when one has that deepened confidence, then this, it gives one the feeling that one is now on the right track, since one has this experience of a temporary purification and liberation by using these specific techniques for clearing the mind, cleansing the mind, freeing the mind. Then one has the confidence that if one follows this path through its successive stages, all the ways to the end, one will reach the true, final, ultimate purification and liberation. So when one gains that confidence, then gladness is born. This is called, gladness is a bad, very inadequate rendering. It's pamoja, which is really, it's a kind of exuberant joy. Then from this exuberant joy, then piti. Piti is a kind of exhilarating joy, elation. I think elation is a better word than rapture. Uplifting joy. Then one who is elated with this exhilarant joy, the body, which means really both the mental body and physical body, become tranquil. And then when the body becomes tranquil, the mind is tranquil, then one feels, one experiences sukha. Sukha is pleasure, but it's something more than the word pleasure, is a rather coarse word, but this is, you call it bliss, happiness. And one who experiences pleasure, bliss, happiness, for one who experiences pleasure, bliss, happiness, the mind becomes concentrated. Here again, the word concentrated is weak. But the mind enters samadhi. Samadhi is the complete collectedness of the mind, composing and coming together of the mind. And so it's a very beautiful sequence that we meet again and again in the discourses to show the process leading up to samadhi. I'll put the Pali words on the board. I realized too late I should have started from the bottom and gone up to the top, since it's an ascending sequence rather than a descending one. Okay, so we start with pamoja, that's what I called it exuberant joy. Then that leads into piti, elation or exhilarant joy. Then exhilarant joy is still somewhat coarse, because there's an element of excitement there. But as the mind continues to train in mindfulness and clear comprehension and focusing on its object, then that coarse excitement and piti in that elation settles down, 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 and the mind becomes tranquil. And then that tranquility of the mind is imparted to the body. So even the disturbance, agitation of the body, subtle agitation, that settles down and the body becomes tranquil. And then when the body becomes tranquil, then one experiences this pleasure, bliss, happiness, and then it is this happiness that is the precondition for the mind to be collected, concentrated. And so concentration for the Buddha, it's not a matter of forcing the mind to remain on an object. It's not like a matter of tightening the grip of the mind on the object, compelling the mind to remain on the object. But it's a matter first of establishing in the mind preconditions for joy and happiness. Then when those joy and happiness, that wholesome, pure joy and happiness arise, then the process is initiated, which will bring the gradual subsiding of the unwholesome factors and the arising of more joy, more happiness, until gradually the mind settles down. And when that happiness and bliss becomes very strong and massive, then just naturally the mind merges into samadhi, just through the concentration or the compressing power of that bliss. Okay, now from this point, normally or in some cases the Buddha might have brought in a transition from a passage like this. Perhaps he could have gone into the jhana formula here. But in this particular sutta, he introduces the formula for four alternate meditative states which come repeatedly in the suttas. They come to be called, in the commentarial literature, they come to be collected under the name Brahma Viharas. And also in the Abhidhamma literature, they're called the immeasurable states, Appamanya. Now, I've tried to figure out the reason why these qualities or these particular states are included in this sutta. And just as a conjecture, this isn't supported by the commentary, but it just seemed to me, when you look at the defilements, the list of defilements in paragraph 3, a lot of them are concerned with like negative attitudes towards other people. Ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, evil wishes. And so, this is my opinion. The Buddha brings in the four Brahma Viharas, or immeasurable states here, because these states are, you might say, the antidotes, the opposites, the diametric opposites of those particular types of defilements, corruptions of the mind that were spoken about in the negative side of the discourse, the types of qualities that are improper for a true ascetic. So one who is going to be practicing the way proper for the ascetic should be developing these four divine states, or four immeasurable states. And what's distinctive about these four particular meditative states mentioned here is that they are states which are developed in relation to other living beings. And there are different ways of, you say, relating to other living beings, different ways of directing the mind to other living beings. In English, we call them loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity. The Pali names. Metta, Karuna, Mudita, and Upekkha. So metta, loving kindness, has, you say, the aspect, the characteristic, the quality of wishing for the true welfare and happiness of other living beings. Karuna, compassion, has the aspect of feeling or empathizing with the suffering of other living beings. And of generating the wish that those afflicted with suffering be freed from suffering. The third, altruistic joy, has the aspect or characteristic of rejoicing in the success, good fortune, good qualities of others who have achieved good sex, who have achieved success, good fortune, and good qualities. And equanimity, I would understand to be the quality of mind which is free from any bias or, say, discrimination amongst living beings, an attitude of equality and non-discrimination. And I'd say equanimity also has the attitude or the ability, it's also the ability to maintain mental poise, equipoise, without being overwhelmed and shaken by either the success of those who succeed and by the misery of those who are subject to suffering. There are specific techniques for developing these meditations mentioned. They're described in detail. Well, actually not in detail. I have to say rather very briefly in the Visuddhimagga. But here the Buddha is taking the case of somebody apparently who's already somewhat advanced in the practice, because initially, according to the commentarial method, one has to develop loving kindness beginning with specific persons. I've explained the method in some of the talks I've given on Saturday, so I'm not going to repeat it here since it requires a full talk in itself. But one begins with specific persons, distinguished in groups, oneself, friends, neutral persons, enemies, and then one radiates loving kindness towards these persons in turn until one develops the ability to radiate loving kindness to these persons equally. Then when one develops that ability, then one chooses geographical areas and one takes the beings, the people in these geographical areas, and one radiates the loving kindness towards them, expanding geographical areas, beginning with one's own dwelling place, say this monastery, then expanding maybe the town of Andover, and maybe the state of New Jersey, United States, then North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, then take the whole earth, the earth as a whole, then one takes the different planes of existence, one could use the direction radiation as described here, extending this loving kindness to the east, extending it to the east, south, west, north, above, below, and then extending and expanding the loving kindness until one is pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Then one abides pervading similarly the quarters with a mind imbued with compassion, imbued with altruistic joy, with a mind imbued with equanimity. In that way, one develops these four sublime states, four divine abodes, each one in relation to the entire world. Okay, so now the Buddha has brought the teaching up to the level of a monk who has achieved this, we call this a level of mastery of concentration, to the point where he is able to radiate the entire world with these four sublime qualities. And now he's going to give a simile to describe this state. Here I'm in paragraph 13. Suppose there were a pond with clear, agreeable, cool water, transparent, with smooth banks, delightful. If a man, scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came from the east, from the west, from the north, or from the south, or from any direction, having come upon a pond, he would quench his thirst and his hot weather fever. So too, if anyone from a clan of nobles, these are the kshatriyas, the administrative, the warriors, goes forth from the home life into homelessness, and after encountering the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata, develops loving kindness, compassion. Whoops. Something wasn't changed there. Altruistic joy and equanimity, and thereby gains internal peace. Then, because of that internal peace, he practices the way proper to the recluse, I say. Then if anyone from a clan of Brahmins, from a clan of merchants, from a clan of workers goes forth from the home life into homelessness, and there should be another phrase, if anyone from any clan whatsoever goes forth from the home life into homelessness, and after encountering the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata, develops loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity, and thereby gains internal peace. Then, because of that internal peace, he practices the way proper to the recluse, I say. Okay, so here the criterion for practicing the way proper to the recluse is gaining this internal peace. But this does not yet conclude the teaching. And by the way, this paragraph here in the earlier section, paragraph 6, it seems just in that one paragraph, the Buddha was sort of knocking away all of the extreme ascetic practices that were being undertaken in his time. Now, in this paragraph, he's subtly undermining the distinctions of the class system that were being proposed by the Brahmins, who are holding up the validity that there were these important distinctions. The Brahmins were placing themselves on the top, then they were placing the warriors or the nobles, the kshatriyas, below them, then the merchants below them, and then the shudras, they were the workers, were just so low that they had no other choice but just to work as manual laborers. And then those who were outside the class system, the outcasts, were just completely hopeless. They were regarded as untouchables. But for the Buddha, all of these class distinctions mean nothing. The Buddha says, if anyone from any class, from any of these classes, goes forth and develops these four qualities and gains internal peace, then he is practicing the proper way. Okay, but still at this point, the Buddha has not yet concluded the discourse. But now he brings in the most important point in paragraph 14. He says, if anyone from a clan of nobles goes forth from the home life into homelessness, and by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge, here and now enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints, then he is already a recluse or an ascetic because of the destruction of the taints. Then the same thing is repeated. If anyone from a clan of Brahmins, from a clan of merchants, from a clan of workers, or from any clan at all, goes forth from the home life into homelessness, and by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge, enters upon and dwells in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints, then he is already a recluse, already an ascetic, because of the destruction of the taints. At that point, the Buddha doesn't say that he is practicing the way proper to the recluse, because he is no longer engaged in the practice, but rather he has completed the practice of the ascetic. And now the Buddha says simply that he is a samana, an ascetic, a recluse, in the true sense of the word. Because the true sense, for the Buddha, the true ascetic is one who has uprooted and destroyed all the defilements. Okay, maybe this should be the basic explanation of the sutta. If there's any questions, then please be welcome to ask.
Sometimes it's hard to tell what's a direct and a consequence. So if we look in paragraph 8, that seems to be, as stated rather passively, I don't know if the Pali is, when this happens, this is born in and that is born.
Yeah.
It seems to be happening almost of its own accord.
Yeah.
Is that right?
You mean the sequence that's done of the way that all of these states are unfolding one after another?
Yes. So, as compared to, you know, paragraph 7 where it says the bhikkhu abandons, I just want to make sure I'm reading that.
Yeah, of course, it doesn't mean that these things happen without effort, but it seems that there's a lot, in my understanding, a lot of effort is invested in the process of achieving this temporary abandonment of these defilements and winning the state of temporary, what I call temporary purification and liberation, then when one reviews oneself as having achieved this, then this gladness or this exuberant joy arises. That arises by itself. Of course, further effort is needed, but just, I think here the point is that these states do seem to come, follow each other in a kind of natural sequence. And there is a sutta which, in Anguttara Nikaya, this is a book of tens, I think, which says that it begins by saying that one who is virtuous, that is, who is established in sila, the virtues, for one who is established in the virtues, no effort has to be made. Let me be free from worry and remorse. Or let me be free from remorse This is the nature of things, that freedom from remorse arises. Is that the way it goes? Dhammataya? Yeah. No chaitanya, no volition has to be, no volitional effort has to be made. But what is the dhammataya? Is that the causative? But doesn't it use dhammataya as? I think so. So dhammataya is the nature of, this is the nature of things, that for one who is established in the virtues, non-remorse arises. Then for one who is free from remorse, no volitional effort has to be made, let this gladness or exuberant joy arise in me. For one free from remorse, this is the nature of things. In some of the suttas, there's, maybe the Buddha uses gives different emphases in different situations. Sometimes he seems to indicate it's almost like a natural process, that once one state arises, it will condition the arising of the next state. In other situations, he says, arouse your energy, do not relax it.
Comparing it to paragraph 7, where it seems much more active.
The word for abandoning, it does imply some volitional effort.
Mm-hmm. It's unfortunately it's not made clear
Yeah, that's why one has to really understand the suttas. One has to read a bunch of them. One has to see them in their interrelationship. So one could say, probably he is developing one of the four satipatthanas, which brings about vinaya, lokeya, abhijja, dominasang, which brings about the overcoming or abandoning of attachment and displeasure in regard to all worldly phenomena. Someone would have to be developing some type of Of course, it has to be established on the basis of moral discipline or virtue. I see them as being, they're interrelated, but I would see metta, karuna, mudita, I would say they're separate states, and that they have a separate, a different distinctive quality. And they develop on the basis of a different, let us say, active thought and a way of thinking. Okay, so since I'm just a relative beginner with all of them, I don't have advanced like jhanic experiences of them. So the thought for developing metta is thinking of people that are relatively happy or relatively stable, let us say, and wishing them to be well and happy. And so the thought is, may they be well, may they be happy, may they be well, may they be happy, may they... This is not taking ones who are afflicted with severe illness, severe suffering, but wishing, may they be free from harm and suffering. But they're not in that situation, but wishing them not to encounter harm, suffering, distress, worry. So wishing that thought for their well-being, happiness, safety, security. So that would be the thought that generates metta. And then the mood or feeling state that arises from that is the feeling state of metta. Okay, for karuna, then one would take people who are really in states of suffering. Then one has to take them, and even what's very effective is visualization. Not like a detailed visualization, but somehow being able to see them with one's mind's eye and be able to understand visually their situation, and then really mentally engage with their suffering, and to the point where it's almost like gripping one's own heart. And then that is what brings up that feeling of, it's an anukampa, which means shaking with, the heart shaking with their suffering. And then it generates that wish, may they be free from suffering. So that is the mode. It's the thought, may they be free from suffering, may they be free from suffering. And since one is actually seeing and, well, mentally seeing and imaging those who are in, and understanding those who are undergoing suffering, then it is generating a different type of mental state than is involved with metta. And that is the mental state of karuna, compassion. Then altruistic joy, mudita. I have to mark these places where it wasn't changed in the revised edition. Then think of a few friends who have achieved some success or have good qualities. And then one sort of rejoices with them, shares the joy in their good success and good fortune. And thinks how fortunate they are, how good it is that they have the success. And then a kind of joy comes up. And again, it's a different quality from metta, but it's rooted in metta. But it sort of works at a different vibrational level, one might say, on a different track. That's the way I would understand it. And then that's the way I understand it. Then in the Abhidhammic way of handling the Brahma, these qualities, the Abhidhamma, it's the somewhat later philosophical, psychological, analytical system of early Buddhism, which treats many of the qualities mentioned in the suttas. It treats as specific actual mental factors, so that the Abhidhamma develops a rather complex scheme of classification, and it treats all of these qualities as being particular mental factors, each with its own precise definition, and the definition is handled in terms of, as Venerable Dhammadipa mentioned 2 weeks ago, was it characteristic, function, manifestation, proximate cause. So in the Abhidhamma system, metta, karuna, that's loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, are treated as three distinct chaitasikas, three distinct mental factors. And it's said that loving kindness, I don't know if I go along with this, but anyway, no, it said that a dose of non-hatred is present in all wholesome states of consciousness. So non-hatred is not necessarily loving kindness. Loving kindness is one particular mode of non-hatred. But compassion and altruistic joy arise only in particular types of wholesome consciousness. But non-hatred is present in all wholesome states of consciousness. But it seems to me that it's a mistake to say that non-hatred and loving-kindness are synonymous, and that therefore loving-kindness is present in all wholesome states of consciousness. Because it seems that loving-kindness arises just as much as compassion and altruistic joy with a particular thought force and volitional, it has its own particular quality. And so while wholesome states of consciousness may not have hatred, and so you could say that they are all free from hatred, but that's another matter from saying that loving kindness is present. Did you study the Chinese counterpart of this yet? Very similar. Any other questions? Okay, then we won't start. I was thinking that we would finish this sutta today, early today, and then start on sutta number 6. Didn't I say about 4 weeks ago that we would start sutta number 6? 5, 6 weeks ago, I think I said that. But we will get to it next week. Okay, so we will do our sharing of the merits. We share the merits first with the devas and the nagas, that's the deities, and the celestial dragon spirits, inviting them to rejoice in the merits and then to protect the Buddha's teaching, the exposition of the teaching, and to protect ourselves and others. Then we invite the devas to rejoice in the merit and achieve all success. Then we invite the buddhas, it's the harmful spirits, to rejoice in the merits and achieve all success. And then we invite all beings to rejoice in the merit and achieve all success. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata chaham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chaham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chaham hehi sampadang punya